comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors. And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It's talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and it's the show where you matter. Now, I've gotten emails from folks today around the world, and I appreciate so much your concern. It has to do with the 6.8 earthquake in northeastern Myanmar. We used to call it Burma. And people read on the internet where this quake was felt in also in Bangkok and in Hanoi. And people have been emailing me concerned for my wife and my son, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I have been in touch with them. They are okay. There was no damage in Bangkok. And in fact, only people who were in skyscrapers in Bangkok felt it. She does not live in a skyscraper in Bangkok, so they didn't even feel it. They didn't know. The skyscrapers were swaying, but the lower, shorter buildings, apparently people didn't feel it. But they're okay, and I thank you so much for your concern. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. If you haven't signed up for it, be sure you do. Go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says K-Files. Subscribe, and then click the link in the confirmation email you get to activate your subscription, and you will begin receiving the K-Files. Tonight, we're going to discuss the deepening mystery of Ratisari Natstogran Badgrasich. Now, you may not know it by that name. In fact, I can guarantee you do not know it by that name, but I can also guarantee that you do know about this mystery. But you know it by a different name. And a little bit later in the show, I'll explain to you how I can make those guarantees. That's perhaps part of the mystery. Tonight's show is a show of great importance. Some shows are shows that are interesting, but on the grand scale of things, maybe not all that important. This is a show of great importance. It's of such importance that I encourage you during this break that's coming up, I encourage you to go to your telephone, call your friends, call your family, and urge them to tune in to this show. It is really, truly that important. I'm not overstating it. I'm not overselling it. I'm telling you it really, truly is that important. The mystery of Ratisari Natstogran Badgrasich. And now you're scratching your head and you're wondering, what in the world is that? Trust me, you know. I'll explain everything. I shall make it crystal clear. I will leave no stone unturned when we come back. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests, at least one of my guests is with me, and we're awaiting the arrival of the other. But I wanted to take just a moment and sort of explain to you the very strange title of tonight's show. As I said, and you saw it on the website tonight, we're going to be talking about Ratisari Natsto Gran Badgrasic. And you're wondering, well, what is that? Well, let me tell you what it is. That is the mystery of the Fukushima reactors, what's going on there. What we were supposed to be able to do last night, and you're saying, well, why didn't you just call it that? Well, I did last night, and look what happened. And I mean, it was, our communications were disrupted immensely, and they may be again tonight. However, I wanted to guard this as close to the vest as I could until we got on the show. So. Now you're saying, well, what language is that? Ratisari Natsto Gran Badgrasic is in the language of Kevinismo. Okay? That's a Kevinismo language. You didn't know what it was, and hopefully opponents of the truth also didn't know what it was. My guests this evening, Ron Stewart and Joe Resnick. I know Joe is with us. I think he is. Joe, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Glad to be here, Kevin.
Okay, and Ron is with us?
I'm here.
Okay, very good. Well, as you just heard, tonight we're able to talk with each other, and I'm using exactly the same equipment here as we were using last night. The settings are all exactly the same, but we don't have the interference we had last night. That's not to say that it might not visit us. It may visit us, and if it does, we will go to Plan B, which you and I know about. but, you know, I can just imagine now that over in the black world, the crypto guys called in special teams to figure out what in the hell is he talking about tonight? Because the title of the show is not in any known language except known to me. Okay, let's begin where we were going to begin last night. And gentlemen, welcome back to the show. You've both been on the show before, and I'm delighted that you're here with us again tonight.
Great to be here, Kevin. Thanks for having Ron aboard.
All right.
Thank you, Kevin, very much.
Well, you're certainly welcome, and I thank you guys for being good sports and willing to be back tonight. Let's begin with something that you have talked about on our show before, but we have new listeners, and they may not have been exposed to the explanation of the technology that you use, which I believe is called ORIE, ORI technology. What is that?
ORI is the acronym or abbreviation for Optical Remote Imaging Enhanced. And what that basically means is that there's an imaging technology that's available that can go to infinite levels of being able to see what is on the macro scale, for example, what's in outer space, or what we do in the microscopic scale, also in that area as well. In other words, the most powerful microscope available today in microscopy is called an AFM, an atomic force microscope. It can go down to about one billionth of a meter. The technology we have recently, we're able to attain levels 100 times more than that on the microscopy scale. And we are doing that in several different projects that we're working on at the time. in the macro scale, we've talked about that before. It actually in space, be able to kind of, if you imagine taking a camera, a video camera, and zooming into an object and being able to bring it up close as if it was just only 10 feet away, but yet it was a mile away. And that's the same type of possibilities that we have here with this technology. So the applications are limitless, and what it can do for mankind is also limitless.
All right, now
let me run and enhance some of that, which you just put out to Kevin and the listeners. The technology, in addition to what Professor Stewart has just described, has some very amazing, really amazing properties, the likes of which I hadn't encountered until I had the privilege to work with Ron. One of the phenomena we experienced when doing this optical remote image enhancement and application employment of a special algorithm and a special piece of equipment that Professor Stewart designed personally, it's pretty amazing in that we see, imagine if you will, a photograph, and contained within that photograph you have visually observable occurrences and items that appear in the photograph that we recognize as, let's say, a chair or a person. Well, when that photograph is developed and it becomes, it goes from a negative into a positive, and our human apparatus can see the positive, there are actually moments in time and space that go into the occurrence and appearance and the transition from a negative to a positive that are not observable by the human eye. Now, what does that mean? What it means is that there are things within the realm of going from negative to a positive in a visual image, regardless of how that image is created. It could be through the TEP technology, conventional microscopy, digital camera, conventional black and white camera, Polaroid camera, for example. Doesn't matter. And it could be a radar image, it could be a sonogram, whatever that image is. When that image is produced and goes from the negative state to the positive state, whereby humans can observe that, there are things in that photograph that the human eye can't see. And what the ORI technology does, literally, has the ability to strip away and move backward in those microseconds and microelements of, for lack of a better word, time. And we're not saying it's time travel, and certainly, if it is time travel, it's nothing like the Jules Vernian type of, where someone sits in a time machine and pushes a button. No, it doesn't happen that way. But what we observe are quite phenomenalistic occurrences that appear as rings. They look like rings. They're rings. I call them rings of time. Ron calls them something different, but I call them rings of time. And I base that on my study of the Amici-Bertrand process. Now, your listeners can go and do a quick Google search on who Amici was and who Dr. Bertrand was, and a special piece of equipment that they designed. Well, Ron took that piece of equipment and moved about 20 generations out, and then configured that along with the special algorithm, the computer algorithm that enables this type of remote enhancement. So, thank you. I just wanted to put that in there.
Okay, well,
that's the technical side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now, using the ORI technology, you have examined the status of these reactors 1 and 3 over in Japan. And I suppose, and we'll get into talking about the images themselves in just a minute, but I just want to know, did you use satellite images of these reactors, or what's the source of your images for these reactors?
We can take any image. Go ahead, Joe.
I would say U.S. Army. These are the images. We're working from the images provided by the U.S. Army and that are out there in the public domain. We don't have any special access to any special. We have available to us what John Q. Public has.
Okay. Now, the news reporting on the status of the situation in Japan has sort of, and I'm talking about the news reporting, has sort of indicated that while it's serious, it's nothing to be really overly concerned about. Yet, and this is interesting, obviously at government levels, not just our government, but government levels around the world, they have information available to them that is not available to the general public. And the government of Germany has responded to this situation in Japan by deciding they are going to get completely out of the nuclear power business. They're giving up all of their nuclear toys. They're getting out of nuclear power generation. And that's significant because 25% of the electricity in Germany is generated by nuclear power. But in response to this thing in Japan, they're getting out of it. So what does that indicate to us? What did they know that we don't know?
That's the $600.
Well, there was a person one time said there's nothing to be afraid of except for fear itself. And matter of fact, that was President Franklin D. Roosevelt in World War II. And that philosophy still holds true today. When persons do not have correct understandings and information, and they're dealing with the unknown, yes, it is scary. Yes, it is something the person does not want to face because you don't know what you're going to have to face. Therefore, the situation is, based on that, I can understand why a government would make a decision to say, well, we need to rethink our position on nuclear energy.
So you're saying that Germany's decision to get out of nuclear power generation is based on ignorance?
It's not based on ignorance. It's based on the fact that you have scientists in Germany who, for example, during World War II, were extremely brilliant and were able to be the ones that were first making atomic energy and researching the subject. And as we know, one of the reasons why the United States was to attain atomic energy is because they gave political asylum to many of the scientists that were in Germany, and they came over to the side of the United States at that time. And when that happened, nuclear energy was born, and atomic bombs were then made. But that being said, the world has never seen an occurrence like we have seen right now in Japan. And the point that makes ignorance, in my referral to that, is not the people or the nation itself, but as to what the future can bring. Because nobody knew a tsunami was going to come. Nobody knew an earthquake was going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen 1 second or 10 seconds or tomorrow. So my point is, as a precautionary measure, because we don't know exactly what the future can bring and what kind of natural disasters can occur, which it seems like there have been many in the last 10 years, that would be more of a decision of not ignorance, but of prudence on the part of Germany.
Okay, so then I would take it that you think it's a wise decision.
Yes.
All right. Now, folks, if you go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, you will see the picture about tonight's show with that very strange title on it, which, by the way, again, is in the language of Kevinismo. If you click that picture, it will open up a site that has been prepared by Ron and by Dr. Joseph Resnick. And it's a slideshow of some photographs that we're going to be talking about. Now, those of you who are watching our TV channel will see them on your screen. And let's dive into it. One of these pictures we saw yesterday, and this picture is an aerial photograph of one of the reactors, and I don't know which one. I don't know if it's one or three, but it's an aerial photograph. This is we see steam rising up out of this building. Now, we're going to go to a photograph that has a white arrow, and that white arrow is pointing at, oh, it says here, reactor number one. Okay, and then we step up and we get a little bit closer using the ORI technology. We get to see what you saw, and there's a red arrow. And, you know, looking at this picture, most people in the public would say, man, I can't make heads or tails of that. It's blue and shades of yellow, and who knows what that is. Looks psychedelic. When you look at it, what do you see?
Those colors represent, Kevin, different elements in the course of their decay as a result of exposure to reactor number three for plutonium. Now, the yellow colors that you're seeing and the red colors that you're seeing, Ron, perhaps you can explain that to Kevin in terms of the gases and the off gases that are occurring there.
Yeah, and let me just tell you, both of you are beginning to break up, so we may have to go to Plan B. But go ahead, Ron.
Well, if you're talking about the first images that are in the top slideshow, that is primarily and only of reactor number one.
Okay, well, I'm talking about the one that has a red arrow, and it says points to the area of partial meltdown.
That's down below. That's the second series.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Where the arrows point to reactor number one and reactor number three, with reactor number three being at the approximate 2 o'clock position. Number one being at the 7 o'clock position.
Well, what do you see in this that tells you there's a partial meltdown here?
You can see what looks like if we're looking at reactor number three. Now, keep in mind, of all those reactors there, number three is the only one that has plutonium. That's the one that causes Ron and I the most concern. Now, if you look at that plume of steam coming out there, directly in front of, below, and to the right of that steam, what looks like honeycombs. They look like honeycombs. The reactor cores are down inside there. The rods are down inside of there. Now, if you go to one of the other drawings, we're really breaking up. If you go to one of the other drawings that have more color, you can see there's a lot of stuff going on in there. And you see in the middle of the honeycombs what look like stars. They look real bright. They're stars. Well, those are the rods. That's the decay of the rods. And they're appearing very bright and very bright because they're burning. They're melting down. Literally.
Let me explain a little bit more about the color coding. What we have here is that the ORI technology has the capability of taking the science known as spectroscopy.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we will be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Professor Ron Stewart and Dr. Joseph Resnick. I gave their bios on air last night, and then they could not appear on the show because they tried, but they were getting all kinds of interference on their telephones. I think you can probably hear the interference being attempted again this evening. And I can assure you, you heard at the beginning of the show, things were pretty clear, and then now the interference has begun. So we'll see how this goes. Now, when we went away for break, Ron, you were describing these rods in meltdown, and people can click on the picture about tonight's show on my website. It'll take them to your website where the slideshows are. So explain to us, we're looking with the ORI technology, we're looking at the rods actually in meltdown. Is that right?
Where the steam is basically coming out is basically where the primary rods are. Now, if you'll go to the image that is isolated by itself and it has annotated text at the bottom of it, and in the top left top corner it says steam, and then it shows an arrow pointing toward that. It says hot point and also steam building heat. Well, we want to break these colors down and explain that a little bit more to show what's going on inside reactor number three. However, let me bring this to the attention. The reason it is extremely important that the ORI technology be used right now to go into these reactors is because the ORI technology is the only technology in the world that has the remote imaging capability of getting down into this reactor and showing by color code what is happening at the molecular level. For example, in this image that I just got through talking about, we see all kinds of reds and blues and purples and violets and greens and so forth. Now, basically, we understand what color coding is. What we see here and what is happening in the ORI technology has done, it has taken the science discipline known as spectroscopy, and it's color-coded each one of these molecular reactions and actions that's taking place inside of this reactor. For example, the areas where you see the sky blue colored areas, that would be oxygen. That is what needs to be gotten rid of, because, for example, if a explosion were to occur, then the oxygen there would only add to the explosive power of what was to happen of the meltdown, and the using the process that known as chiorain or liquid nitrogen and putting them in there slowly and gently in controlled stages would immediately deplete that oxygen. Where we see the yellow colors, that is where there's less thermal activity. The next higher temperature color would then be orange, and the next higher temperature would be red. And then where we see some of the greens and the blues and the violets, like in the east or the west part of the photograph in the middle, that would be an area where the aqua arrows point. That is an area that's in transition of different types of molecular activity. And here's the point. If someone walks into this area and does not have an appropriate knowledge of what they're walking into and how much the radiation is at one point or another, the maximum that they can stay under these kind of conditions as of March 22nd, 2011 would probably be 15 or 20 minutes tops. Would that not be correct, Dr. Resnick?
That's correct. Kevin,
do you want to elaborate on this a little bit more, my colleague?
I'd like to get back to what you mentioned about the spectroscopy and discuss what we know is the visible spectrum. Now, listeners, what you're seeing in this picture, and we've isolated it as best as we could in terms of the dimensionality of the containment building. So, think of what you're seeing in this rendering as a comparison of the visible light spectrum, the color spectrum, with negative energy being black, and positive energy, as it were, being white. Now, where the arrows, the aqua-colored arrows are on the left of the screen, where you actually have the Amici-Bertrand rings manifesting, that indicates clearly of a transition mode. Now, these molecules, they do one thing, and they only occur in one place other than a controlled instance such as this, and that is when a black hole occurs or a supernova occurs. This is exactly on a mesocosm scale of what happens when a black hole is created. These molecules are moving toward an event horizon. They are moving from the positive energy on one side to the negative energy spectrum on the other side, being black. So think of it in terms of black and white. And as these molecules move, they transition their state from one state to the next state, and that corresponds to the different colors that are manifesting in this rendering in consideration of the light spectrum, the energy, magnetic light spectrum, and the periodic table of the elements. Each one of those colors that we see on there corresponds to an atomic number and a color and a radiograph in the visible spectrum, as well as the periodic table of elements. So based on those scientific knowns, we are able to tell you, for example, what that red stuff probably is. It's probably some type of oxygenated oxide with, again, being critical to remove the component of oxygen from this situation. And to do that, the cryo-rain technology is a viable technology. Ultimately, they're going to use, ultimately I'm going to say, whether they use our technology or just pirate it, they're going to use the liquid nitrogen.
All right, we'll get into the solutions. All right, we'll get into the solutions in just a moment. I want to dig into the problem a little more. I want to make sure that we all understand the scope and magnitude of the problem before we move to the solutions. Now, we're watching in these photographs in your slideshow. We're watching atomic reactions, I guess we could say, take place as these molecules are transitioning to the next state and so forth. So that in itself is an atomic level reaction, is it not?
Correct. Yes, it is. On the submolecular level.
Okay. Now,
let me add to this and say briefly that the colors that we see here, and this was a condition as of March 22nd and beginning of March 23rd, 2011. My point being here also that in what you see in these different colors is a demonstration of the dark blue areas, for example, would be contamination. Now, the point that Dr. Resnick was pointing to earlier about a transition taking place and what we would see here on the very submolecular scale, what you would see in a black hole, does not mean it will transform into a black hole, because here's the point. Reactor number 3 has the most enriched core that there is on all 6 reactors, and it's made of plutonium. However, it is at a refinement level of only number 12. It takes a refinement level of between 18 and 20 from matter to then dispose itself into antimatter. So what you have here is the same molecular atomic reaction that's trying to attain from a point of matter to antimatter, but it cannot get there because we only have a grade number 12 in these plutonium enrichments and not at 18 or 20. Would that not be correct, Dr. Resnick?
No, that is correct. However, let me add to this. Let's negate the possibility of a black hole simply because the proper type of fuels are not there. The one of chief concern is the plutonium. The uranium depletes at a slower rate, but although the possibility of a black hole is extremely remote, there is the possibility of what's called the magnetospheric internally collapsing object. It's called MECOS. Now, it's just theoretical in nature. Now, keep in mind that what we're observing here, likewise, are theoretical in nature. These types of reactions have never really been seen at this level before. So it's all theoretical, and the physicists will tell you the same thing. We don't know what's happening. But what scares me most about this situation is not the black hole, but what's happening there is those reactions are leading toward an event horizon. The event horizon is going to be something, and it's probably going to deal with the atmosphere
as opposed to a black hole, because the particles aren't enriched enough to achieve the type of reactions that are required to create a black hole and move beyond the event horizon. But there is enough there for a Micos event. Your listeners can just Google Micos, M-E-C-O-S, and they'll understand what we're talking about here.
Let's say that we get to this MECO event, and it happens. What's the result of that?
I don't know. I don't know if the atmosphere is going to implode and burn up all of our oxygen, or the skies catch on fire. I don't know. I don't know. Can't say. Can only speculate.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something that we cannot pinpoint. With a certainty, and what we're talking about is what we know of the scientific process, and what we're stating in both hypothesis and theory. However, we know that there are certain factors that do happen in atomic reactions, and because of this, this is not to scare anyone or anything like that, but it's just to explain, basically what's happening in reactors. Now, what we have to stop and take into consideration, think about this for a minute. Let's take the technology of ORI and the liquid nitrogen completely out of the picture, okay? What we have here, we had one reactor in Chernobyl, and that, from what I understand, was a total meltdown. And then we had Three Mile Island, which was a partial meltdown. Now, the point is, we have six reactors here. We have four that are damaged, and my concern is reactor number three and number four. Number one is also a concern. Number three is also a concern because it has the enriched plutonium. Now, here what we also have in this situation. You can look at my website, and you look at the last two pictures below the slideshow, and this is an actual fact. This is hardcore fact, and even if you remove science away from it, this is plain geography. This is plain anything a person could look up. But we have the Fukushima nuclear power plant, which is on the east side of Japan, about in the middle. And then, if you look very closely, each one of those stars that have a little solar circle in the middle of it, below that, in a southwesterly direction, we now have three additional power plants that are fairly close to one another. So here's my point. If you have a problem with one of these reactors getting a problem and you have even a partial meltdown, you not only have one reactor to contend with, you have the other ones that are also there present. You also have the possibility of a problem with the other nuclear power plants that are southwest of that. But now, here's the truth. They're also active volcanoes.
Okay, I tell you what. Hang on to that because we have a break coming up. And it's coming in just 12 seconds or so. So we'll pick up there with problem of the power plants, the nuclear reactors being grouped so close together when we come back on the other side of this break. Don't go away, folks. More interesting stuff right after this. To the Kevin Smith Show, and my guests this evening, Professor Ron Stewart and Dr. Joseph Resnick. Professor, just as we went to break, you were about to make a point, and I had to stop you in midstream, so the floor is yours.
I think we may have lost. Is he back, Ron?
Okay. Well, we will continue, and we'll see if he rejoins us. If not, we will go to Plan B. And let me say, I don't know if you can hear it, Dr. Resnick, but you guys are being interfered with.
Yes, undoubtedly.
Yeah. And let me say to the anti-American, anti-constitutional morons that are doing that, hey, You know, the time is coming, and you guys need to be watching what's going on in Egypt. Your time is coming. Okay.
Yeah, well, the time is here. Ron, I don't think Ron is going to do that, Kevin. We probably ought to go to Plan B real quick.
All right. We will go to Plan B, and folks, we'll reconnect with our guests here in just a moment. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We are going to attempt to press forward here and to be able to get this information to you. If you do a little research on both of these gentlemen, you'll understand why we're having this problem. Let me make sure, Ron, you are back with us. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and Dr. Resnick, you are back with us. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm present.
It is amazingly much clearer here on Plan B. We'll see how long it stays that way. Okay, now, Ron, you were making a point when we went to break, and I don't know if you recall, I do not, but I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, and if you recall what it was you were about to say, I want to give you the floor. It's yours.
Here's my point. Ori, isn't that strange? Ori is very important to use right now because it is can monitor inside the reactors what's going on.
Okay. So it can go where people cannot go.
Right. And even if they would not, even if they wanted to use a different method to try to solve the problem with these reactors, the point is that the Ori technology is the only technology that can get down in the reactor and show by the science discipline known as spectroscopy what is going on. Now, what I said before is let's take all the science out of the situation. You have four reactors here that are damaged. You had one at Chernobyl, one at 3 Mile. You have four here. You have two that are badly damaged or severely damaged. You also have three other nuclear power plants that are southwest of this Fukushima power plant. If you'll look at my website, or excuse me, Dr. Joe Resnick's at my website, and the two pictures on the very bottom of the second slideshow, you'll see that there's three other power plants below, in the southwesterly direction below Fukushima, and in the event we do have a meltdown, the concern I have is not only that you have one reactor that's damaged, but then you have a reaction to a second one, and suppose you have then reaction then going back to those other power plants as well. Now, that said, there is also a earthquake fault line that's somewhere between 1,200 and 1,400 miles long on the east side of Japan. We don't know how bad that was damaged or not in the recent earthquakes since March 11th and also the tsunami that hit the eastern part of Japan as a whole. We also have behind these power plants some active volcanoes. On the south end of Japan, we also have another fault line. Now, put what I just said together without no science whatsoever, and we have the situation we have here. The point is, there's no time to waste. We don't need dilly-dally. We don't need government red tape. We need to get in there right now and get rid of the oxygen and this molecular transitional atomic reaction that's taking place. Even if it's much, much, much less than what I'm saying, it needs to be taken care of before it develops into something worse. I mean, let's not have another Gulf situation where it takes months and months before the well gets off.
All right, we have to step away for break. For those who are watching our TV station, we're going to reroute some stuff. On the TV side, we'll be off air for just a couple of minutes. I'm going to try to make this better. We are back, and I do apologize for the long delay in coming back, but you know, I've been at this for a long time, folks, and this is not the first time when we've been attacked. So we do have a few tricks up our sleeves, and We've worked a little magic, and we'll see how well did it work. Maybe it didn't, but we will certainly try to continue. I told you this is an interview of tremendous importance. We are talking to probably the two most significant people in terms of this situation in Japan, probably the two most significant people on this planet. Dr. Joseph Resnick is a physicist. He's an engineer. He's a scientist who has a very, very long, I guess we could say, pedigree when it comes to working in extreme high technology, both for NASA and for other parts of the government, with, I can tell you, an extremely high security clearance. Ron Stewart, we're talking to a guy, Professor Ron Stewart, who knows the ORI technology inside and out because he developed it. And as they are attempting to tell us, this technology, and they've been working together in this project, this technology allows scientists and engineers, people who would be concerned with trying to solve this problem, it allows them to see inside the reactor. It allows them to see what's going on in that reactor in ways that no other technology allows. It's obvious to me that there are people who don't want you to hear this. It's obvious to me, and I think to you, that there are people who want to keep you in the dark. They want you to be mushrooms. They want you to sit in the dark and eat a steady diet of crap. And it's their crap that they want to feed you. Well, you don't get that here. And, you know, if these guys and gals, whoever's involved in doing this, if they had a spine even 2 inches in length, they wouldn't be doing this. They'd be standing up for constitutional rights, freedom of speech, and freedom of information. Yeah, the politicians they work for mouth that, but it's all mouth. In the real world, on the ground, where the rubber meets the road, they are as anti-constitutional and anti-freedom as the despots they decry around the world. Well, I'm hard to shut up, and I won't shut up. And so long as there's a way, we're going to bring you the message. You know why? Because you have a right to know. I don't give a tinker's damn what the government says about your right to know. The Constitution says you have a right to know. And to the best of my ability, you're going to know. So let's see. Ron, are you still with me?
I am.
Did my speech scare you off?
Oh, no.
Okay. Dr. Resnick, are you still with me?
Yes, sir, and I stand with you in defense of the Constitution, sir.
Outstanding. Okay, so we're looking at this situation in Fukushima. We're seeing that this thing is in partial meltdown. It is going through and moving toward an event horizon of some type, as is evidenced by the pictures that you have been able to come up with from the ORI technology. You can see that it's moving toward an event horizon. One of the things that has been suggested as a solution for this is just bury the thing in concrete. What do you think of that idea?
Absolutely. Will you speak first, Dr. Resnick, or do you want to speak first on that?
It's impractical. I think that
that reaches a new height and level and vicissitude of stupidity. That's what I think. What are you going to do? Just bury it and leave it there for 20,000 years? Or are you going to fix it and clean it up and deal with it properly? Because I got news for those guys. It's not going to go away. What Professor Stewart was pointing out in terms of the existence of those fault lines, I want to add something to this. You have there a situation that is never presented heretofore at any time on this planet, on this Earth, and at one place. The proximal reactors all contain like materials. Those like materials do in physics what's called neighboring. They really like their neighbors. Well, guess what? They're in a real special club because there's only a few of them around, a few like molecules, and they're all similar, and they all do the same thing. They move from matter to antimatter. That's what they do. Now, nothing would please those elements more than to gather a whole bunch of them together, put them on the bus, and say, hey, boys, we're all going to the same place at one time. Let's go. That's what Ron is getting at here, and that is the significance of what could possibly happen. And the proposal to just dump sand and cement on it, it's impractical. You have to take the oxygen out of that equation so that you can go in there and properly remove the rods that are in a state of meltdown. And it can be done. You have to get those molecules at close to or as near as possible to absolute zero and stop their molecular travel. You have to stop the journey. You got to put a hole in the tires on the bus and stop it, because they're all going to one place. They're going from negative energy, or from positive energy to negative energy. And somewhere in between, there will be some type of event horizon. And God forbid we have another earthquake that fractures any one of those remaining 12 or 14 reactors on that little island. Because the island will just go into the ocean, and that'll be that, and it'll go someplace, and that'll be that. And you'll have, 100 million Japanese people gone. And not to mention what's going to go up into the atmosphere and show up in my grandson's milk in 2 weeks.
Okay, Ron, what do you think about it, Ron?
Well, let's make it more simple. If there's a fire, it has to have oxygen to continue to burn.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when you put dirt or sand on top of the fire? You extinguish the oxygen. Or let's make it even more simple to where a three-year-old child can understand it. You light a match. What's all around it? Oxygen. You blow real hard, and what have you done? You've taken the oxygen away, so then it extinguishes the match. It's just that simple, and it is what it is.
Okay, so if they put concrete on Three Mile Island, they put concrete on Chernobyl, but if that's not the answer, what is the answer?
Well, the problem with making a slurry of concrete and mud basically is what they would do. Okay, it dries, but it has to cure. Now, you talk to anybody that knows construction, and they if they don't have an education or whatever, it doesn't matter if they have an education and no construction, but concrete cures. The older it gets and the longer it stays around, the more it cures. However, concrete, as you have contraction and expansion of the ground because of the environmental conditions and the climate around it, you have, the cold that's going to contract, and then the heat, during the summertime, it's going to expand. Now, the point is this. In those slurries that they have, there's what they call microfissures. And those microfissures are just microscopic little cracks. And guess what's coming out of those microscopic little cracks?
Radiation.
You take a Geiger counter, you go to Chernobyl today, you would still get a reading. You go to Three Mile Island, you still get a reading. However, there are maintenance programs, and you can pretty well maybe possibly Google it up and look for yourself, but there are maintenance programs that have to go back every so often, and the correct people have to go back and try to find these cracks and reseal them. So, that said, what is the difference between what we propose as far as liquid nitrogen and a slurry of mud?
Well, liquid nitrogen, if you flooded it, what would happen? If you're ever in science class in high school and you poured liquid nitrogen on a carrot and you dropped it, it would crystallize and break. So by flooding this area with liquid oxygen, all you're going to do is add to the problem, because you're going to crystallize and you're going to crack other things. However, the chiral rain technology that we have at our disposal with Dr. Denise DeBrook, who's the inventor of this, it would very, very gently and slowly be increased and put in small increments. And as soon as it would come out and hit the oxygen, it starts to solidify. Once it solidifies, it will be able to be sealed. As you build upon that, you build one layer upon another layer upon another layer upon another layer upon another layer. You have reinforced layer from one layer to the other one, to the other one, to the other one. And as the thicker it gets, it solidifies into one big, large area of solidification above the reactors. But now what it also does, according to the laws of physics, it eliminates the oxygen in and around any area that the liquid oxygen is gently poured into. But once it solidifies, guess what else you can do? You can put sealers
nitrogen.
On it.
You mean liquid nitrogen?
You can put sealers on it. It will stay.
Yeah, you said liquid oxygen. You meant liquid nitrogen.
I meant liquid nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
And the significance of what Ron is pointing out here, Kevin, is that this remediation process can be controlled. There's an element of control that exists in terms of using the cryo-rain process, as opposed to just dumping the slurry and dumping that stuff on it.
Okay, so if you just dumped the liquid... If you just dump the liquid nitrogen on it, it would explode, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
If you just dumped liquid nitrogen on it, it would explode, wouldn't it?
No. The nitrogen removes the catalyst. The catalyst for the explosion is oxygen. That's why you have that steam and you're having explosions there.
So why would you use cryo rain instead of just dumping liquid nitrogen on it?
Well, you're painting the wall with a big brush there. It doesn't work that way. We call it cryo rain for a reason. What we do is we rain, literally. We create a sieve. Part of the patent is we have a sieve through which the liquid nitrogen is dispersed. And it falls literally as droplets. And as it falls through the cryo-rain dispenser nozzle, it literally changes phase from the liquid into the gas. The gas is extremely heavy and moves immediately to its antagonistic element, oxygen. And it completely removes that oxygen. It puts the oxygen up into the air, but makes the heavy molecules of the radium and plutonium stay on the ground. We put that stuff up in the air. So you've got to liberate the oxygen, get the oxygen up in the air, keep the heavy metals, and keep all the debris and that stuff down on the ground where we can clean it up and put it in a bucket, in theory, and take it and drop it in the Grand Canyon out in Mesa County where they're going to put it.
The steam that you see coming out of the reactor right now is allowing radioactive particles to emit from the cracked core. Now, if you cover that core and you're able to do it with the chiral rain method, you've eliminated that going into the atmosphere.
That's right. It's essential that we keep it from going up into the atmosphere. Not only would that accomplish the enhanced remediation capability, but it also can lessen the prospect of a MECOS event or the probability of moving towards some type of event horizon with all the givens. So it's pretty important to get the oxygen out of there, keep the heavy metals down on the ground where we can deal with them, and deal with them in a controlled method. Today, we've identified sources and machinery and equipment and helicopters and everything that we need to put this project together. and we've laid that at the Japanese power company's feet. We've laid it at the UN's feet and said, hey, look, this is a viable option. And there's one gentleman dispatched to the U.S. Transcom who seems to think we're looking pretty, this technology seems pretty viable. So, and that guy knows his business. I'm not going to
okay.
give out any name. But
all right. Now, using your proposed method, how long would it take to bring this reactor under control?
Well, you have three of them there that need to be treated. There are resources, some resources available over there. However, what we're proposing is location of turnkey operations that are proximal to. We don't want to put the instrumentation that is used to produce the liquid nitrogen on site. We would want to locate that stuff remotely. And as we bring those online to maintain control over those reactions that are going on, we would utilize available resources and assets, human and material assets, that are available first in Japan, because they've got a wonderful group over there. These people are volunteers. Get that. They're volunteers. You don't have to pay them. They love their country and their people so much, they volunteer to get that exposure and go and try to help. God bless them. I'll tell you, God love them. They're volunteers. But we would, what we propose to our people is, you know, we bring in the necessary assets, Sikorsky, Scott, Grange, at least two of them, and there are 15 of those units available right now in Japan, Kyoto, Honshu, in the regional area that's maintained by the Japanese people's, it's not Department of Defense, but it's the Japanese people army, and they've got, you know, they don't call it an army anymore since World War II.
But
there are materials and assets available there, and additional assets that would be needed to be brought into the region. That's a matter for logistics, and we're in touch with logistics people who can certainly handle that.
Okay, now, as you envision the project, you obviously would have to do a project management Gantt chart. And
sure.
From start to finish, on your Gantt chart, what do you project as the time it would take from you get a telephone call right after this show and they say it's a go? How long would it take to say we've got it wrapped up?
We could have boots on the ground, literally boots on the ground because of the transport and the location. Boots on the ground, equipment in place, the supply chain, we already are on top of the supply chain. I'd say we could actually start to do something realistic within, that could
24.
Be observed.
Within, yeah.
Well, don't say 24. Give us a little bit of time. You know,
36 to 48 hours,
at least. 36 to 48 hours. You know, that would give us boots on the ground and assets there to commence the process. So, you know, 36 to 48 hours, I mean, we're there. Yeah.
Okay, and then how long until you can say it's under control?
At reactor number 3?
Yeah.
I'd say within 5 days. That's given that we have the assets and the boots on the ground and the tires on the road and the rubber on the wheel, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Within 5 days.
However, a cooperative effort with the Japanese government and also anyone else that they would be willing to allow to come into their country. For example, if it was a military operation, we would be happy to invite any and all help and work with them in any form, way, or manner we could to be able to get this situation under control. And the United States, any other countries that may be through the United Nations, or if it wanted to be handled through the United Nations, whatever the system is, we need to do it now. We don't need to do it tomorrow or the next day. We need to start ASAP, yesterday.
All right, I want to back up to a scenario. It's something that both of you have mentioned, and it's something that I think we ought to examine. Let's say that we get all of this under control, and they get their reactors, they get this cleaned up, get the reactors back online, and they're producing energy again with these reactors. And so everything, and they've made whatever modifications they think they need to make to prevent this from happening in the future. And we hit a phase where there's another gigantic earthquake like this, And maybe both of the major fault lines go at the same time. Anyway, big chunk of Japan falls off into that rift, and these reactors go with it. Now we've got reactors underwater. They don't just stop just because they're underwater, do they?
No.
What happens?
They would get worse as they went and became subject of the intense pressures. Let's say, in a worst-case scenario, they're down in the Marianas Trench, 7 miles deep, and that stuff implodes, and those pressures, those types of pressures would actually feed a reaction. Those types of depths and pressures are very bad.
The situation is dire, and we don't know what is going to be the decision of the Japanese government, which they are very eloquent people and highly intelligent people and very honorable people. But we know that
Ronnie, got you again. The break's taking over. We'll be back, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and I'm very happy to report, gentlemen, that during that last segment of the show, the little trick up my sleeve that I had worked substantially, and we were able to hear everything very clearly with minimal interruption, and hopefully it'll hold through this segment of the show. So let me just check. Professor Stewart, are you still with us? And Dr. Resnick, are you still with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, hey. I bet that's got some spooks torqued. Okay.
I put on my Kevin Smith voice for that one, though. Good evening. Okay.
All right, now, we were talking about, and I want to explore this just a little bit more. We were talking about what happens if these reactors actually get dumped in the ocean as a result of subsequent earthquakes. Look, Japan is not the only place in the world where there are reactors built very close to the shoreline where they could get dumped in the ocean. We've got some in America like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what will it take to make folks around the world, including America, to say, you know what? No matter what it costs, we've got to shut those down.
Oh, I don't think that's practical. I don't think that's practical right now. There's the infrastructure to replace the energy modules that are in production now and have come online in the last 35 years. That would be like turning off a light bulb for about a third of the world's population. That's not practical. And we just don't have the infrastructure for the biofuels industry or the alternative fuels industry. We just don't have the infrastructure in place. But just to mention, you know, Kevin, you mentioned about reactors being in the United States, and there are seven up there along what's called the can-do border. Those frighten me. Also, just to mention in passing, we have in the state of Michigan over 23 reactors that are online presently. I believe seven of them are dormant right now, or in shutdown for repair mode, repacking, that kind of stuff. But that said, the state of Michigan, if it were a country, would be the 13th strongest nuclear power on the planet, just based on the number of reactors there up in President Obama's area, up in Chicago, up that way. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
Just think if something would happen up there. Oh, I shudder to think of it. Same thing along the can-do border,
mm-hmm.
the can-do circle, they call it, those seven reactors. If one of those cores would crack and you'd get a leak, just forget about the west or the east coast and New York City the whole way down to the Delmarva for about 10,000 years. Oh, yeah. And forget about all the people.
Here's something you got to look at. And the point is that yes, the infrastructure in the countries are built to where it's going to take a while to replace nuclear energy, but how many times can we have an incident like Chernobyl or Three Mile Island or this here, and then keep saying, well, you know, we've learned. Where do we draw the line before we say, you know what, now I can see the forest because of the trees? I mean, how much can we expect our planet to take? How much can we expect for our children, our progeny, our grandchildren, and the future to whom this might affect to take the same situation? If there's going to be a actual learning from this situation, it has to be made by each country because they have their own sovereignty. However, if the transition to other types of energy, for example, biofuels, which the governments completely want to get off fossil fuel because of how it's corrupting the environment, and for example, a biofuel can possibly take a jet, and 80% or 90% of the emissions that come out of that jet are basically returned to the atmosphere in a clean state. Now, you're not going to find hardly anything in the world that is that clean. So my point being is that part of the problem is these nuclear power plants being looked at and policed in a sense to where to make sure they're up to par. Now, we have things like earthquakes and so forth and so on, and those things can't be helped. However, take, for example, if you have liquid nitrogen in place and an earthquake did come, and then it was to be able to, let's say you were to redevelop liquid nitrogen and come up with the next generation to where you could take liquid nitrogen and before it would turn into a solid immediately, suppose it took 30 seconds to a minute or 2 minutes or whatever detention time it would take. My point being, if you had modules in and around the nuclear plants with liquid nitrogen to where it could immediately freeze these rods, then at least what you're doing until it can be corrected, you've bought time because you have eliminated the problem. And that is where I believe some of the solution possibly could be.
That's where it's moving. It's moving toward having on-site production capability to produce emergency backup as contingency plans in the event these types of things happen again. And Ron, you've made a good point here. There are good things that can come out of this terrible, terrible tragedy. One of them is we've learned now. We're learning now. And we're learning that we can do things to circumvent negative outcomes or prevent negative outcomes in the event something like this happens again, which it will.
The problem, though, gentlemen, we've also learned here in the United States that the government is a giant source of hot air. It's an energy source all its own. It's full of methane. And I'll give you an example. Congress, a few years ago, the problem with illegals coming across our borders was so massive, and the government was absolutely so inactive that citizens went down there and secured the border. And Congress was jumping through hoops, just going crazy, because citizens had a right to do it. But it, of course, evidenced the fact that Congress was completely irrelevant. And so they jumped through hoops and they promised, we're going to build a fence. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, is the fence there? No.
No. Neither is the electronic fence.
And so, the point is we've seen them lie to us so many times that it's one thing for us out here in the real and normal world where there are a few gray cells active to say we've learned some lessons here. It's another thing for that bunch in Washington to follow through on it. And unless they get some money out of it for their own pockets, they're not going to follow through on it.
Unfortunately,
my question is this: this is going to take cooperation of the greatest and the most courageous kind. The forefathers of this country who made our Constitution were courageous. Our mothers and fathers were courageous to come to this country as immigrants and to have children that can enjoy freedom here. The point is that are we going to be courageous as not only a society, but a government and a world? Are we going to come together and help one another in this situation and help the person the United States calls ally, Japan? Yes, we already are. However, are we going to come together in the sense to where it's going to take a massive effort to control the situation? And are we going to do this with open hands saying, here we are, take my hand, I'm ready to help?
I think the American people are where you are. I think that, and we always have been. But the greatest impediment at this point, in my opinion, and it's just an opinion, but it's one that's no secret, the greatest impediment to forward progress and good in a situation like this is going to be Washington, D.C. I don't think they get it. They still don't. They still haven't understood how much trouble they're in with their own electorate. I don't think they have the capability, pardon me, of understanding the scope and nature of this problem and the ease of solution. I don't think they've got it, but I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
I would like to invite the United States government, military, United Nations, whoever, to take this problem as you, like a bull by the horns, fight back and say, no, we are not going to let this take place. We are not going to have this problem. We're all neighbors, whether we're different countries. Here's my point. If you and I were standing together and we're walking down a street and an earthquake did not happen and we'd pass one another in the city of New York, we would probably never even see each other again. But if an earthquake was to come, and if somebody was to reach out and instinctively try to help you, that's when the best of the spirit of mankind takes place. Reaching out to somebody that you don't even know, and in that moment, you don't even care about your own self. You reach out to help them and save them. That is instinctive. That is called survival. And my point is that in that survival, for that one moment, we rose above what we are as humans and now have become the intelligent beings that we are meant to be.
Do you think it's possible?
Are we going to do that in this situation?
Well, do you think that's possible with
yes,
the current atmosphere that and their track record in Washington?
And I challenge anybody out there not to believe it. Because you know what? It has happened. We have seen that goodness of mankind come forward before, but now is the time to take this situation, because we're not dealing with just one reactor. We're not dealing with just one power plant. We're dealing with a number of problems that if we do not take necessary action quick enough, do we want it to go to those other problems or for the potentiality to be there? Here's my point. If you and I are walking out in the country and you know there's quicksand right there, do you have, and it says, be careful, quicksand, you see the sign, like we see the sign right now over in Fukushima, do we have to walk in the quicksand to know there's quicksand? No. All you have to do is look at the sign and go around it and avoid it. So my point is, we don't avoid this, but we correct it by taking the necessary action.
Mm-hmm. I hope it works the way you envision it. I sincerely do.
I believe in mankind. I believe in the human spirit. And I believe the goodness of what this country is. And, of course, I just want to believe so badly that the United States is the greatest country as they say they are, And the point is that as a leader in what they have is democracy, and this country is to exemplify that, it's again time for them to step up and say, look, we take the lead, we commit our military, we commit whatever it takes, the resources, but we do that at the invitation of Japan. And Japan, most graciously, I believe, will hold their hand out and say, come.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I hope you're right, Ron.
I hope you're right.
I do too.
It will take, there's going to have to be an old-fashioned fundamental hellfire and brimstone revival take place, revival of constitutionalism take place in Washington, D.C., because it is the swamp it began as. And maybe it can return to what it should be. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Professor Ron Stewart and Dr. Joseph Resnick. Ron, once again, the break caught you in mid-sentence, so I want to let you finish your thought.
Look, as everyone else who's listening tonight, I want to talk to you just on a human basis. How else can I say it more than what I can feel, and I hope I'm coming across this way? We need to do something. We need to do it now. We need to reach across and contact our congressman, whoever, and we need to reach forward and say, let's do this. Anyone in the military, anyone in the United Nations, if anyone is listening tonight, and if anything we have said makes the tiniest bit of sense, makes the tiniest bit of logic, it has a ring of truth to it, then the point is, if it has that ring of truth, and if it's something that you can see that needs to be done, we're inviting you. You don't have to use us, but let's get it done. But we're the only ones right now who have the technology that can do this and take care of the problem.
Well, I hope that appeal works, and I can assure you, all over the government, it's lit up tonight. I can assure you, because we look at the server logs, agencies of the U.S. government that you wouldn't even suspect exist are logged in, and they listen every night, and I hope sincerely the message that and the appeal that you just made, I hope sincerely that they respond to it and that it gets through.
All right. And I can tell you, some folks in various DOD components with whom I've engaged over the past 4 or 5 days are extremely supportive. But a word in defense of all those good friends of mine and the people with whom I enjoy reach back, their hands are tied too. It's the Japanese people who have to make a move, and it has to be done. It has to be done on an international basis. This is where Mrs. Clinton needs to step forward, and the president needs to get forward and say, "Hey, come on, let's do this." As Professor Stewart said, let's just set these people down. We've got some people here. They've got a plan. They've got logistics. They've been in touch with our people. We'd like to offer that in the spirit of fellowship and fellowship in based on our treaties and based on our international laws. Let's do this. We are offering these material assets and human assets. Let's face it, they don't have the assets. We have the assets because we've got these guys in Washington, the Ways and Means Committee, and they got the ways and they got the means.
So they got the ways
and they got the means. So we need to stop putting around and just go and do this, and you call those people up. I can tell you, I've been in touch with some of the highest level senior military officers and division officers in the Department of Defense.
they would go in a heartbeat. The ones I've spoken with, in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
In a heartbeat. But they're soldiers, and they need to be told what to do. So
that's the crux of the problem, as I see it.
I know.
That's where the problem is. All right, but
I
look, you know, Dr. Resnick, you know from our past experiences that there are tons of people in the government in high places listening to this show every night.
Yes, they do.
And you know, some of them by name.
Yes, I do.
So let me say to them, you know what buttons to push, folks. You know what where the levers are that need to be turned. And, you know, if you think this is, as Ron Stewart says, if you think this is viable, if it's got a ring of truth about it, you need to push those buttons. You need to turn those levers, because if you wait, you know, you folks know who work in the government, that if you wait for the elected officials to get through with all their speeches and debates on this, if it even comes to that, if it even rises to that level, it's going to be too late. So you've got to make your move.
Can I interject for a second and say this?
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I want to just say. Suppose 2 days goes by, 3 days, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or whatever, and for some miracle, this situation would continue. The point is, these are damaged nuclear reactors. They are not going to repair themselves. So, you know, why wait and let them continue? Even if they did last another 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and you continue to deteriorate, at some point there's going to have to be a massive plan for people to get together and put the best minds in the world together and say, look, we're going to have to either do it now or later, because it's not going to go away. So wouldn't it be better to do it sooner and later and have more problems later, where now if it's nipped in the bud, there could be less problems? Now, if what I said does not make sense, if what I said does not sound logical, and if what I've said does not sound rational, well, then I'll leave the program right now.
No. Listen, Kevin, there are things going on in that reaction that Ron and I have not disclosed to you. There's some real serious stuff. And Ron and I agreed we won't disclose, and we don't want to cause panic. However, it's essential that people listening to this, and there are some people in very powerful positions laying in their beds right now listening to us. I cannot overemphasize or stress the egregiousness of what we see in the photographs and in the renderings. They're not our photographs. They're U.S. military photographs. But we see stuff in there that is absolutely frightening. Frightening to the point that when I saw them the first time, and based on my knowledge of the ORI technology and what I was seeing, and I'm a physicist, I'm a scientist, when I saw those things, I did, and people in my life will tell you, I shuddered and cried for 2 days. Me, grown man, 6 foot tall, 218 pounds, I ain't afraid of nothing. When I saw that stuff, I cried. And it was based on what Ron and I found. It's real serious stuff. But it's serious.
Let's take away the ORI technology. Suppose they were to take, and now Joe, you know this will be right, Dr. Resnick.
You're going to have to make this real quick because we're up against the end of the show.
Fly over the reactor and use infrared on it. Use infrared
yes.
on it and show what your infrared technology will show you. It will show you a lot of the same things you are seeing in the ORI technology, except the ORI technology is taking it several generations beyond what the infrared will do. But let's take current technology, take a helicopter, fly over number 3, get as close as you can safely without causing a problem to, you know, life or limb or whatever, and do an infrared imaging of this reactor. I would love to invite any scientist or person or the Japanese government, please allow this to be done so it can be studied, even if in secret, and you will see. You will see that some of the things we are saying, you will also see. So therefore, if you can see it in the simpleness of your technology of today, why should it not, what we are showing you, also be true? Because the ORI technology may be beyond that to a certain point.
Gentlemen, I hate to do it. We've reached the end of the show. I hope both of you will stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this one in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, I told you this was an important show. It's been a chore to get around the people that didn't want you to hear it. But you got to hear it. And the reason is, you have a right to know. Thank you for being here with us, and we'll be back tomorrow night. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.